Australia's leading podcast for men with issues.
Mark. How am I supposed to start if I'm not supposed to say Mark?
Dude.
Wake up. It's actually a wake-up call, mate.
Yeah.
Oh, no. It's like call to action.
It's normally a lot more professional than this, James. I just lost myself there. I didn't think you were doing that.
How? I tell you what, you start.
No. No, you start.
Okay.
But not like that.
Mark, how are you?
Fantastic, Derek. How are you?
Good, mate. I would have got a lot of feedback the other week on Lockie, basically his story about, you know, his drug addiction and his alcoholism.
We had great response and lots of comments on the various Twitters and what's Facebook called now?
What do you mean what's Facebook called?
Facebook's not Facebook anymore.
Meta.
Oh, Meta. Officially got changed, did it?
They've announced it. I don't know if they've done new business cards.
Really?
Yeah.
But so that's been changed on actually the...
Yes,
the,
Meta.
Is that right?
Yes.
And what's the meaning behind that?
It is an attempt to rebrand from being a fascist, horrible, worst company in the history of the world.
Really?
To something less than that.
Are you on it?
Once you're on it, you can never get off it, mate. You
really?
Know, no. I mean, I'm on there, but I'm never on there. But you can never... It's like the mafia. Once you're in... There's one way out. And when I say the worst company in the world, and I mean that in a satirical sense, not in a sue me for every cent I've got sense. If you're listening, Mark.
Well, on today's show.
Satire.
On today's show, I thought I'd bring on this interesting guy. I met him maybe about a year ago. And
where do you meet all these guys, Derek?
I meet people all over the place, mate. They're just drawn to me, these guys. But anyway, I met him and we chatted here in Nearish, and I thought it would be a good idea to have him on because I think his background and where he's from, it would be an interesting story to tell. So, James Wilson, welcome to the Men With Issues.
Thanks very much for having me on. Yeah, when you said it, yeah, it sort of goes both ways. The dinner party conversations have been
interesting. So... You're initially from Zimbabwe.
That's right. So I was born in Zimbabwe. And
hang on. Zimbabwe or Zimbabwe?
I thought you'd catch that.
I say way, but I don't know any better.
Correct us, mate. What is it?
I say Zimbabwe, and I know people are going to laugh at that.
Really?
It's probably Zimbabwe, to be honest.
Right. Is that you trying to be inclusive by saying we instead of way?
Oh, because it says we at the end. I know. I think the correct pronunciation is Zimbabwe, to be honest.
Right.
That's the local pronunciation. But yes, I do get laughed at quite a bit because of the accent.
I love the accent.
Well, we don't have accents, Derek, so you and I, so it's
really?
It's good to have someone on with an accent.
Well, people tell me I've got an accent.
Really?
Yeah, I was going to say, he's definitely got a little bit of a touch.
I've got an accent.
Where's your accent from, Derek?
Well, it used to be from East London, but now since I've been living in Australia for 30-odd years, it's sort of plateaued. It's sort of got a bit of a mix to it. It's just neutralized. It's funny because when I was chatting with my friends in England, the girls say to me, oh, your voice changes, your accent changes. It's not like I do it on purpose. It just happens. You sort of get a bit confused. Yeah, exactly. Self-conscious. And you try not to speak like that. But then again, when I speak to my friends in England, they say to me, God, you sound like an Aussie.
So you do not sound like an Aussie to most Aussies. I mean, you have a strong English accent.
Yeah. Some people say to me, I thought you were Australian.
Who are these people?
I've got no idea. But I grew up in East London. So really, basically called a Cockney. It was very much like being on a set of Oliver. All right, Governor, can I have some more porridge, please? Is it porridge? What did they say?
I don't think he specifies what he wants. But because there's only one.
More food.
There's only one, one dish on the menu.
More food.
Gruel. I think it's some sort of gruel. Well, did you get gruel?
No.
I see. Being completely from not the side of the world, that's full English for me.
Is that right?
The funny thing is with the English accent, there's how many? I don't know. There's thousands.
Yeah.
You guys can almost pick out like the tone you come from, I suppose. Australia, however, is pretty much, apart from North Queensland, pretty much the same. You can be from Melbourne, Perth.
I can pick a Melbourne accent.
You can you can pick a Melbourne accent.
I think I can. Okay. I think the Melbourne accent is, and you're right about, I think, the North Queensland accent. There are words that people in Melbourne or Sydney say that we don't say, different expressions for things, the way they pronounce Newcastle or Newcastle or Jared or Gerard, or they wear swimmers instead of bathers or togs and those things. But I can pick a Melbourne accent. I'm almost, I would think I would have a 90% accuracy on a Melbourne accent.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that before.
Well, that's why I have a podcast, James, and you don't. To be honest.
Can pick a Melbourne accent.
But you know, when I first got here from England, the Perth accent used to go very high at the end of a sentence.
Really?
I said this to someone the other day. I said the first thing I noticed when I landed here was every sentence was a question.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in.
No, it's fine.
I think it seems to not be that way anymore.
Mm.
I don't think it's...
I think you're right. It's changed over time, and I don't know why.
It's genuinely what
maybe because there's a lot more Europeans, migrants coming here, and things are changing for, you know.
We see a lot more US TV, a lot of I mean, our kids would barely watch an Australian TV show and they pick up the vernacular and the slang from the American shows and the cartoons and the NBA.
Yeah.
I know my boys do. But yeah, our language has, and I am told, and you know, it's only when you do get a podcast and you actually hear yourself talking that you realize what you sound like and what your accent sounds like. But I've been told I have quite a neutral Australian accent, so I'm not.
You do,
yeah.
I think you do too.
And I don't know why that is. It's nothing I've worked on. It just, it is what it is, I think.
Is that the Perth accent?
Yeah, well, no, I don't know that it is. But if you've ever listened, well, I know we're way off track here, but if you've ever listened to the old TV, like the 1960s, the ABC radio announcers, they'll show some footage of, you know, an Anzac Day parade or something happening, and they sound like nothing like, you'd never hear a person talk like that now, trying to sound more British. And I think we've evolved. Maybe it's all the influence of people like yourself who've come here, and our accent is evolving over time, I imagine.
Last word on accents. So usually when I meet someone that's from your part of the world, I always say to them, are you South African?
Oh.
Is that annoying?
Derek.
It's funny. It's not to me, but there are some people who do find that annoying. But I don't find it at all, because there's only a handful of people from where I'm from, and there's a lot more in South Africa, and there's a lot more South Africans here across the board. So, and look, for me, the accent is very close. You usually need to be from there to pick the difference.
Sure.
We all sound the same, which we probably do, but...
it's a very contagious accent. I always find that when I hear your accent, I always want to say, I lost the keys to my car. Or... I have diplomatic immunity.
Okay.
That was from Lethal Weapon 2.
So that accent that you're doing is, and I am not from Zimbabwe or South Africa, but that is the stereotypical South African, probably Afrikaans accent. And all I would say, Derek, is after that performance, I would say, who's the dickhead now then? Hey?
Was that South African?
Which one?
The one you just did.
Yes. Was it the same movie that you were quoting?
Was it?
Lethal Weapon. Lethal Weapon 2 or 1?
Did he say that?
Yeah.
I don't recall.
Because Mel Gibson called him a dickhead.
Right.
And then he ends up, you know, with him at gunpoint, or he's fallen in a hole or something. I can't remember what it was. I think he's in a hole or a ditch or something.
I haven't watched Lethal Weapon 2, so I'm going to have to put that on.
Well, there's put the VHS out.
But yeah, I suppose. But when Blood Diamond came out, that was a fun time, because that's when everybody went to town.
Yeah.
Obviously, Leonardo DiCaprio's performance, which I thought was very good.
What was his accent like? I can't remember.
I thought it was very good. It was supposed to be a Rhodesian Zimbabwean accent, but apparently it wasn't. But I thought he was brilliant.
Well, I do know, and I've got South African family, and so I've heard lots of South African accents, and they're largely British heritage. So I think I can tell, as you know, James, well, you didn't know until recently, I am an expert on accents, and I think I can. And one thing I will know from having South African relatives, and also I think Canadians and people from the States are the same. I think Canadians don't like being asked what part of the States are you from? So if in doubt, I'll say, where are you from? Or are you Canadian? And if they're American, they're not offended to be called
that's
Canadian.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's true. Whereas the Canadians might get offended.
Yes.
Or they tend to actually get offended yes. by that.
Yeah. But Americans are like, oh, actually, I'm from Minnesota or wherever. So that's a tip, Derek.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
Yeah.
No, but I mean, Derek, you would have had that enough times. Is it offensive to say that your accent... So if someone says to you, and they're not going to say this, but say they sign, but you're obviously from Ireland. You're not going to be offended by that.
Oh, of course not.
Yeah. So I find it weird when people get offended by...
If they said I was from Pakistan, I would be very offended.
Well, Derek is half Irish. So it's funny you picked that up, James. Maybe you've got the same skill that I've got. You just haven't developed it yet. So Derek is half Irish and half Jamaican.
Well,
essentially.
Yeah, I guess. Well, but
bloodlines.
Yeah, so but to speak. When I did ancestry DNA, it's actually
both of you. Well, cool. I mean, the Jamaicans were originally slaves taken from Africa, just like the US were.
Yeah.
So you're both African.
Correct.
African.
Oh, well, if we're going to go on that road.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm probably going to go back to Ireland and England.
Have you actually had your ancestry DNA done?
I haven't, but my uncle did it.
Yeah.
The only reason why I haven't is because my mum's side is fully Irish.
Yes.
Where she was, her parents moved out. But my uncle did it on my dad's side, and it was fully English. So it would be a blend of English and Irish, I suppose.
Were your mum's Irish heritage, was it Catholic Irish or Protestant?
It was Catholic.
Catholic.
Yeah.
And your dad's side probably would have been Protestant. That's unusual too, to blend those back in the day. That didn't happen a lot.
Yeah. I suppose. I think probably at my grandparents' level, it would have been strange, but because it was
after
the fact. Oh. I mean, after, you know.
Now, no one could care less. Don't even notice, but even my parents, even when my parents' vintage, for a Catholic to marry a non-Catholic, you know, you weren't sent away from the village, but it was frowned upon, and you couldn't get married in a Catholic church if you weren't marrying a Catholic, even probably 25 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. So we're all half Irish, more or less. Everyone here is Irish. We should be doing Irish accents.
We're having a Guinness while we do this.
Matt, what do they drink in Zimbabwe? What's the beer? You were too young when you left.
Yeah, I was too young, but
You weren't drinking beer back then?
Well, there's probably a few people. Yeah. The locals drink something called Chibuku, and then there's Castel, which is the main beer in Southern Africa. So Castel Lager is the...
Really?
Is Chibuku a beer, or that's a
It's a concoction. It's a way to say that. You'll find all sorts of bits and pieces in there, and it's absolutely disgusting.
Really,
that's shocking.
They probably make it out of potatoes, do they?
Everyone seems to make something out of potatoes, don't they?
Or potatoes
ferment whatever you can find,
and then
throw it in a glass.
And now people call it gin and sell it for $90 a bottle.
But let's get back to James.
Yes, enough about
us. It's not about us. Yes,
it really is about us. But if we don't have guests, we don't get to talk about us.
So let's start off then. So you were born and bred basically in Zimbabwe.
I was born and bred in Zim. My family had been there for, on my dad's side anyway, several generations. So we were farming well established. And
what were you guys farming?
Zimbabwe's main... export was tobacco, and still roughly is. It's one of the best places in the world to grow tobacco. Mm. So a lot of tobacco, but all sorts of things, cattle, maize. It was and remains an amazing farming country, and it really is just built on farming. So I had an amazing childhood, to be honest. Grew up on this unbelievably beautiful farm, mountains and dams, and ran wild. Was amazing. Was
were there? And I probably know the answer to this, but just for the people listening who don't, were there wild animals roaming the farm?
That's a good question. I get that a lot. There wasn't wild animals roving the farm, but there were wild animals that roved around, and every now and then we would have them come through the farm. We had elephants, we had leopards, all types of buck, antelope, obviously baboons. Yeah, that's one of the big contrasts between the two countries is the amazing wildlife. And then here there's degrees of rats and kangaroo mixtures.
Degrees of rats.
But yeah, so there was...
We had some movement in our roof a couple of years back. And we got the
pest guy up to have a look.
Got the pest guy out, and he came out, and he was South African, and he goes up there, and he comes down, and I said, "What was it, mate? What was up there?" And he goes, "You got Reuters. You know what that is? So it's the name of a rat, a house rat,
right?
But I called it Reuters.
He wanted to get the actual genus and the whole right.
Well, he knew the species.
Yeah. And that's just so he could charge you $380.
Well, you got rid of it, mate, so right. I was happy with that.
How did he get rid of it?
Who cares? No longer exists.
You absolutely nailed the accent.
Oh, really? I don't want to know how he gets rid of it, as long as he's got rid of it.
Reuters.
Anyway, get back to where were we?
Yeah, so Zim, just to create a bit of a landscape, I suppose, it's a very small country, a population of 10 to 12 million, but really built on farming, roughly about sort of 6,000 commercial farmers.
Mm. Then we're talking back then.
Back then.
So what year are we talking about?
So this was up to about the year 2000.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So it was up to about 2000. There's other sort of industries, but that was what I grew up in. And my experience was we didn't have local schools because we were all farmers. Pretty much everybody was farming. So all the schools were boarding schools, very, very English-based. My brother and I were sent to school sort of 2.5 hours away to an amazing boarding school, and we would sit from the age of 5, we'd be there for a couple of weeks and then come home for a weekend sort of thing. So, and that in itself was awesome, incredible way to go to school and grow up.
Were you physically hit at school?
From to the time you go to boarding school. I mean, it's not terrible. You just get smacked on the bum, beaten on the bum. I don't know how to say it without sounding too drastic.
Beaten on the bum sounds all right.
You mean smacked?
Smacked on the bum. That's not the word. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, it sounds a lot worse than what it was. I mean, it was like with a plank of wood or a cricket bat or something like that. But it used to be...
Sorry, hang on. I thought you meant a slap on with a hand.
No, it was not usually a hand.
With a grey nickels.
Yeah. So they're using a
pool shot.
A bat or what else? A plank of wood.
It was just like a plank of wood. Derek, it wasn't that bad. It was just a plank of wood.
Yeah. It sounds a lot worse than what it was. I mean, it's a smack on the bum to like a 10-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And you're doing it with, like, you've usually been messing around with your 5 mates and you're all going to get a smack on the mouth. It's not going to leave you scarred or any incense like that. If anything, it actually brought you closer together. So I when people say it's the worst thing, I actually thought it almost bound us together. Whenever we did something naughty together, you'd end up going through something like that, which then you'd be in the shower the next day and be like, whoa, look at the size of that bruise.
Yeah.
So it wasn't. And it was very rare, to be honest. So it wasn't bad as such.
Zimbabwean friends, mainly black?
I mean, my growing up was at school, essentially, so it was a mix. Yeah, so, it was a mix of...
So in that private school, were there black kids in the private school?
Yeah, it was 50-50.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the country has a developed middle class of black people. It's not like it's just white people who have money and black people don't have money as such. Yeah, so no, that was 50%. And most of the private schools when I was there were probably more 70% African and then probably 30% or 50-50 sort of levels. But the issue was, as the country went, that developed middle class of all colors left and tried to leave, because why wouldn't you? If you've got skills and qualifications which you can get to another country, you're going to try and leave. So
So did your parents employ a lot of people?
Yeah, so we had working on the farm. They worked on the farm but also lived on the farm. So we had quite a big community. There was probably about 300 people living on the farm, which was around about sort of 60 families. So about 60 workers on the farm. But within that, we had a section which was essentially the workers' area as such. So there was houses, schools, a pub.
All on the farm for the workers.
All on the farm for the workers. Yeah. Yes, there was a whole section that basically was where they lived, I suppose.
And were they all paid the same, or they varied in what they were?
It depends on what they did on their job. Yeah, so there was all as with any business, there's all different roles within the farm. So they were all paid sort of different salaries according to that.
Yeah,
but yeah, so I mean, that was, if you can imagine, that as the basis for how the economy worked, where there was all those farmers and then all those sort of families and communities set up on the farms. That was the foreground up until about the year 2000. So as a kid growing up, I mean, it was pretty awesome having, you know, all these people, you know, 300 people, you know, you grew up with. And to it, as a white kid growing up on a farm, you were surrounded by obviously African kids. And I mean, as a child, you don't see color. And then Zim was never such a racial society as South Africa was. So we were lucky. We grew up playing soccer, you know, I never learned the local language, because all the African kids, all they wanted to do was learn English.
Back then, did they have like health care? Did they have like, how were they looked after?
So there was, I suppose, within an area, so say 10, 20 farms, you would have a central clinic. You'd usually have schools. So for those sort of
three. So can I ask a question? Who funded the clinic? Who funded the school?
It was all done by the farmers.
Oh,
so
good.
The farmers would fund.
Oh, fantastic.
Or there's no government. There's no government support. There's nothing like that.
At all.
There's nothing at all. So yeah. So any running of the schools, the clinics, anything like that, would a lot of the funding came from all the farmers.
So looked after, basically looked after.
Yeah, 100%. It was. I mean, there was a level of pride to it. You know, by having that community and being able to provide the livelihood for people and that sort of thing.
Mm.
So yeah. So there was a sort of a whole community built around all the farmers and what they sort of provided to the areas and all the workers and kids. And I'm not saying it's the perfect society in any sense.
Yeah.
And I can certainly see from the outside the issues that existed, but it functioned, you know. Mm-hmm. It meant that children could go to school. They could get a level of healthcare, which doesn't exist today.
Yeah.
That was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Now that doesn't exist now. So there was a functioning community and society, and it although there was a racial inequality, I suppose, it was a lot better than what it probably has ended up today.
And then what happened?
And then in about the year 2000, essentially, when the government was under the country was under white rule up until about 1980, and then it changed, and it fell under the rule of a man by the name of Robert Mugabe, and he was pretty good for a while, and then he turned into a bit of a tyrant. And by the year 2000, the country had got to a point where they were going to get rid of him, and he decided he needed to do something drastic. And he decided he was going to go on a campaign to basically destroy this. A lot of the opposition came from the farming communities. Obviously, the white farming community had all these workers, and this was where the opposition was. And his idea was to basically destroy the opposition by removing all the farmers. You would remove the opposition. So he essentially just one day walked out and said, as of this date, there will be no private ownership of land in the country. And you basically will be told when to leave, and you will have to leave. So yeah, so in stages over the next sort of 5 years, basically the army or police, whoever would turn up and basically say, it's time for you to pack up and leave. So yeah, so we were lucky in a sense. We were given to the end of 2003, and my dad was lucky in a sense. He was told, you've got one more year. At the end of the year, you need to be gone. We couldn't sell anything and we couldn't take anything, but it meant that we could prepare to leave, and that was when we left.
What were you told? Who would take over the farm?
So it's very corrupt in a sense that the government has their elites.
The cronies.
So they basically just hand it to family and government officials and bits and pieces along those lines. So basically all the farms were distributed amongst whoever would like a farm who was connected to the top political class. And essentially they were, you know, with no farming experience, with no background and with no real interest. They just wanted to own a farm, you know, I suppose. They would turn up on the day and with the army or with the police and just say, it's time for you to go.
And the workers would stay, but then the crops would fail. And
well, it was difficult because that was the hardest part. You know, the workers fought in many cases to try and help the farmers stay, because they knew as soon as that was gone, that was their livelihood. But and they had nowhere to go, so they would try and stay, and they would try and make some sort of go of it. But in many cases, it was to no avail. And often the issue was that a lot of the workers had supported the opposition. Basically, they got what was coming for them. Mm. You know, a lot of them were beaten, were killed, had their houses burnt to the ground, and had everything taken from them as well. So yeah, so it wasn't a nice situation, I suppose.
The economy was obviously failing. Did you notice that as a kid?
It was probably the last few years. It got really bad towards about 2008, which obviously I was gone. But in the last few years when we lived there, there was severe shortages of everything. Fuel was always a big problem. It was very difficult to get petrol. The issue was the Zimbabwe currency was just worth nothing. When it suffered hyperinflation and became worth nothing. And then when we as a country wanted to buy oil, you would have to buy it in US dollars, and obviously you couldn't convert Zim dollars into US dollars, so you just couldn't buy fuel.
And they were the only country to produce $1 trillion note, weren't they?
That's right.
And but what would $1 trillion note get you, do you think? Like, is that
what could it buy you when it came out?
Like a hamburger?
It was worth the equivalent of $5,
right?
And that would have been for 5 minutes, you know. So $100 trillion is worth $5, like, and the reason it stopped as quickly as it was produced was because the paper was worth more than what was actually printed on it 5 minutes later. So
wow.
Going back to the shortages, they were going into a grocery store, you couldn't get milk, you couldn't get, you know, because it didn't, as a farmer, you would sell something, and by the time it got bought on the other end, the money wasn't worth anything, so you would just hold and hope. And you could, I remember when I was at boarding school, the one time, and this always sticks in my mind, is we had tomato sauce, which was a luxury, to be honest, at boarding school. But we didn't have tomato sauce, so the kitchen made tomato sauce with tomatoes that were growing in the
fields.
They just sort of jammed them up together and put them into the tomato sauce containers. And I remember when people started using them, that always stuck in my mind. Everyone found that very funny.
Be hard to get out.
That's nozzle, organic. That's yeah, what I know. We call just organic. organic tomato sauce.
So yeah, so there was shortages of everything, and I mean, you could see the country was deteriorating like anything. Roads were going. There was no electricity. We used to have power cuts.
And what about physical danger? Were there ever threats of violence at the farm towards the end? Were you concerned people would come and just take things, or?
Yeah, so there was always that element, because there were other farmers who were killed and there were farmers who were attacked, and it was rare, but it did happen. So I mean, there was always the threat of that happening. We luckily, my dad managed to negotiate the situation quite well, and he a lot of the violence came when people didn't listen to some degree, you know, and they thought, you know what, we're not going to leave, you know. Whereas my dad was sort of the opinion, we've got no chance here. When they tell us to jump, we've got to jump, because no one's coming to save us. You know, this is the army or the police. You know, who are we going to turn to? So, in that essence, we actually just evaded it to some degree. My dad was always of the opinion, I can always start a new life somewhere else, but if my kids are killed, that's my life over. So,
your dad sounds like a pretty smart guy.
I think in hindsight he was, but it was hard for him as well. Mm. You know, like, I think it was like, I've just got to do this. You know, when you talk to him, and I, that's what I remember as a child. Well, not as a child, but I remember when we were in those stages, was my dad was almost very businesslike about the way he just did it. You know, there was no emotion to it. And that's probably come out in the wash at a later stage in life with dealing with the situation. At the time, he was very businesslike. He was like, that's where we're at, this is what's happening, and that's just what we got to do.
Well, there's probably some element of post-traumatic stress related to that. At the time, you do what you need to do to survive and to make sure you're safe, and then down the track, it must be, looking back, it must be quite traumatic, you know, for all of you, I can imagine. And how did you get here?
We were quite lucky, because this idea of the land redistribution wasn't a foreign one. It had happened in a few other countries across Africa, and there was no doubt that in some form it was going to happen. But my dad got wind of this idea that maybe it was going to be radical, and what it turned out to be in about 1998, so a couple of years before. And he said, at the time, the Australian government was coming out to Africa, because Australia was trying to grow at the time. It was an issue with population growth, which is quite hard to believe now. But they were coming out to Africa and coming to visit and saying, you know, if you've got a certain amount of money, you can come across and live in Australia. And basically, I think my dad tallied up the assets and said, look, we qualify. Can we come across? And said, yep. So
can I just ask a question there? So yeah. My assumption was that you weren't allowed to take any money out.
So this was in 1998 when we still owned everything.
Yes.
So when the Australian government came and we applied, we said, look, we've got this farm, it's all ours, okay, we qualify? And they said 100%. And then we actually came out to get a visa of sorts, which we never thought we'd use. We came and visited Australia and we had a wonderful holiday. And then, and at the time my dad thought, I'll do this as a backup plan, but never intended to use it, I suppose. And then when everything went south, luckily we had prepared it to some degree. And the issue was obviously going to be, we had said we were worth so much money, push come to shove, we're not. But luckily the Australian government never asked for us to prove it ever again, because we had applied and been approved years before. When it came push shove, we didn't have anything when we came across, but they never checked.
Right.
So in saying that, though, at the time there was obviously a degree of understanding with what the situation was, so I think they weren't going to be too critical of people leaving and running and that sort of thing. So so we got very lucky.
My wife's South African family, when they were making plans to come out, I've heard they would make what they call LSD trips, which to Australia, look, see, deposit. And they'd come out with their diamonds and diamond rings and necklaces and leave them here and then go back. And then I guess because you were limited in how much you could take out, and I think still are from South Africa anyway.
Mm.
But that was a way to, they couldn't stop you if you had a nice diamond ring, but you might leave it here and then go back to South Africa and do the same thing next time.
That was good planning. And there's two top tribes in
Zimbabwe. Zim is split into two, yeah. So there's the Shona tribe and the Matabele tribe.
And they got on?
No, they don't. They don't get on to this day. There was something happened back in 1980. When they fought the war, they fought together.
But that's when we got independence, though, in 1980.
Yeah, so they fought together to that point. But the Mugabe was from the Shona tribe, and the Matabele basically wanted, because they were still separate tribes, they wanted power as well.
Yeah.
And basically there was an event that happened and a killing of a bunch of people, which is still to this day not being resolved as such. But yeah, it's funny that even something like that is still an issue. And I remember I went out the one night and I ran into an African guy here, and my friend I was with said to him, he said, "Are you?" So I started speaking Shona to him. And he got offended, and he was like, "I'm a Matabele, that's offensive to me." And I was like, "That's just so bizarre."
You were speaking?
No, I wasn't. My friend was.
Sorry.
Because he could speak Shona. Yeah. And he started speaking Shona to this guy, and he just turned around and said, "I don't speak Shona, I'm a Matabele, that's very offensive." And I was like, it's so bizarre to think, we're in a whole different country.
Yeah.
Years gone past.
Yeah.
And stuff like that still,
But it's very similar in other cultures as well.
Yeah, absolutely, But I think that's just a point of moving here and sort of, when we were there and all the issues that existed and everything going wrong, I remember thinking, man, the world must look at us and think this is just a breadbasket and we should help and all this kind of stuff. And then leaving and arriving and being in a first world country and realizing that the world is actually just made up of a lot more countries of that are like that. You look across Africa and it's just a basket case in many cases, and so many issues. And South America's got countries which have similar issues. And it's very, in the scheme of things, there's a lot of countries which struggle through these sorts of issues as such. So yeah, that's just one of the things that I realized arriving here, I suppose it's a victim mentality. When you're in it, you feel like a victim. And then when you look out, you're like, geez, there's a lot of people a lot worse off than what we ever were, I suppose.
Zimbabwean names. I read that they call their kids names that they want their kids to aim for success in life.
It's very common for them to name kids after just everyday things as such.
Yeah, that's what I read. Because they would pick up certain words of English.
Yeah.
Or days of the week.
Days of the week.
Sunday.
All the days of the week. Sausage, salad.
Sorry. Hang on.
These were names of people that actually worked on the farm. So the names that I can remember, there was Monday, it was every day of the week. There was sausage salad. There was Toyota. And then there was obviously the English names as well. They quite liked to use English names, even though they didn't speak a word of English.
Yeah.
It was like picking up a word.
So they picked up a word. They liked the sound of the word. Mm-hmm. And they think, oh, name kid that.
And a lot of names like innocence and chastity.
Mm, yeah,
and
yeah.
All those.
Like the headline on the newspaper would read, innocence was found guilty. Yeah. Yeah. There was always players on words like that, which was quite funny. But yeah, that's true. I remember, and we had a very good swimmer for a long time, a girl by the name of Kirsty Coventry, and she went to the Olympics and won a bunch of medals. And when she did, she became the golden girl because we didn't have anybody, essentially. Yeah. But when she won the medals, there was the listings in the newspaper of the kids she had, and it was like gold medal, silver, individual medley, you know, backstroke, all anything that could be was were the names that came out that followed that. So,
is that right?
So yeah, no, that's 100%, and it wouldn't surprise me.
But it's funny how they wouldn't ask someone, butterfly. Oh, you know, I'm thinking about calling my kid salad.
Well, yeah, but that's completely normal. Mm. Like the person you're going to ask, that's just normal. You know, it's a sense of pride in that sort of thing. As you say, like you'll give the name something that they're going to wish them to be, you know, like CEO. So you call the child CEO.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the kind of the way they sort of did that as a, you know, speaking quite generally about the more tribal sort of Africans as such. That was, yeah. So that did exist. And it was quite funny.
It's a good job I didn't grow up there in my vocabulary because there'd be a lot of fuckers running around. When you arrived in Perth, what did you think?
It was a massive shock. A massive shock.
How old were you?
I was about to start high school. So luckily I had just finished high school and was going to senior school.
Yeah.
What was your accent like the day you landed? Can you give us a demonstration?
It's pretty strong now.
Yeah, I don't think it would be much different.
Not now.
No, if I put it on, it's gonna go South African. So it's I'm not
gonna... Well, you can work on, you can think about that one.
But yeah, I remember landing and I remember driving at the airport and my dad took the scenic route past the sea and he was sort of showing the sea and all this sort of thing. And I remember just thinking, man, this place is bizarre.
Your dad was driving?
My dad had come a couple of weeks before. So he flew over 2 weeks before to find a house to bring us into. And, I remember driving and then we actually stayed the first night at the Rendezvous Hotel because he wanted to, you know, really spice up our landing. So we stayed there. And then we went off to the suburbs and waited to start school, I suppose. And it was bizarre. I remember sitting in the house that we had rented and, trying to wrap my head around, like, this was where we were going to live because, I mean, we'd been on this huge farm, you know, this massive farm and I'd never seen such a small, I mean, even in the main city, the houses were on these big blocks. There was no houses next to you. And I remember sitting in the back and thinking, man, everything's so small and close to each other. And it's bizarre, you know, you can't go fishing. You can't go ride a motorbike. You can't do anything.
Yeah.
It's quite strange. So,
so initially shocked when you got here, you weren't thinking, you didn't think, oh my God, this place is beautiful. You were thinking.
No, I thought the other, I thought, geez, this is not nice.
Right.
Because I mean, I've been on this amazing farm, you know, in the middle of the bush and that's what I'd grown up with.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, as a farming kid, you always think of town or city kids as unlucky and bizarre and weird and in a sense that carries borders. Everyone internationally thinks the same. But yeah, it was just more just trying to be like, this is how we're going to live. This is how people live. And then going to school, And that was a huge experience as well, you know, being completely foreign. I'd been at boarding school all my life and suddenly I was a day scholar kid, completely foreign, very different schooling system.
Boys and girls?
So...
And in Zim,
it was just boys.
Yep.
But also the schooling is very, because of it being all boarding school, it's very built around sport, whereas most of the schools here don't play, obviously, apart from the private schools, but it's very sport focused, whereas most of the schools aren't really here as such. So as a sporty kid, that was a touchy point.
And you would have been into rugby and cricket?
I was a rugby and cricket man. But luckily down the line, my parents managed to move us to a private school. So that was a little bit more settling, but yeah, those first probably 3 years, I begged my parents truthfully to send me back. I said, send me to boarding school back in Zim and I'll fly back in the holidays. You know, why can't I? I've got the friends I was at at boarding school with are still there. I just want to go back to some degree. And I think that was very difficult on my parents because they were sort of caught in two minds. Do we do that to, you know, for him? But in the long term, it's better that he does settle here, even if it does take a number of years. So, and they're obviously fighting their own battles at the same time. You know, they're trying to find their own feet. They're trying to make a living.
Did you feel bullied at school here?
I never felt bullied as such. I felt to a degree that I was out of place. It's probably the way to say that. You know, and by no means it was a treatment as such. I just didn't feel like I fitted in a lot of the time. And maybe it was partly my own doing. You know, I probably longed for home and my friends and probably going to, you know, there was that sort of thing which probably didn't help the settling in, whereas if I arrived with a different mindset, it probably would have made things better. But
it's amazing how the similarity of you and I mean, you know, you're a lot younger, but this we both had very similar feelings of not belonging, not fitting in, you know, when you first arrive here, because it's so different, but, and because you develop friendships, you know.
And when you look back, I don't know if you would think that, but when I look back, I often think things, you know, you live in that bubble and you don't see things for what they are. You know, you miss opportunities. And I look back and I think, geez, if I had arrived with a different mindset, if I'd been able to, it's not that I just wasn't able to get to that point. But if I had, I would have been able to take advantage of a lot more things and probably do a lot more and settle a lot better.
I agree.
When you do settle, you suddenly like, wow, there's so much I can do.
Yeah.
What am I
really? Massive opportunities here.
There's huge opportunities. Yeah. So the biggest thing is now when I look back, and it's taken a very long time, I look back at what my parents went through and what they had to give up and that sort of thing. And all that we went through was to get to this point where my brother and I have a world of opportunity ahead of us. I honestly believe Perth is probably one of the greatest places to live from a family perspective in the world. You know, I don't think there would be many places better than this, with endless opportunities, and hugely grateful for everything that I've been given. And that, I think, is the blessing in everything. You know, because of those experiences, it's made me be able to be hugely grateful for what I've got and what's ahead. Whereas if I hadn't have gone through that, maybe I wouldn't be of that perspective. Mm. You know, maybe I would take things for granted as such.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, but that's just life.
Did they know anyone when they came here?
Yeah, so we knew a couple of families. We knew a couple of families that had come a similar sort of way that we had. So that was a reason for us coming to Perth, just so we knew someone. I suppose, you know, we didn't have any other family or anything here. But it's they were just people that we knew. They weren't close friends of my parents or anything like that, so they weren't overly helpful in the long run for them settling anywhere, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, that was why we came to Perth, just obviously there being quite a big community of South Africans here and that sort of thing. It sort of helped make the jump across, and people often ask me that, why there's so many South Africans or Zimbabweans or whatever in one place. And as anyone who's not from here will say, it's you go to where you have people you know, because it helps the landing.
Of course.
You know, it's difficult to go into a complete, you know, where you don't know anybody, as anybody does. So,
and it's that the closest city to back home.
It's the closest stop. Yeah. The first stop off the boat. Yeah. And in fairness, it's probably the closest thing to many parts of Africa, or of Southern Africa, I think, anyway. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
True. So were there any blown away moments that you had coming at that age when you walked into a supermarket? Did you?
Yeah, it was endless. I'll tell you one thing that I did notice there was no African people, which was bizarre at first. You know, like none. You know, like to go to massive events and to be like, wow, everybody's the same to some degree. I was like, this is quite strange. It was things like riding the train. You know, like the train. Like you catch a train. Like public. There's public buses, trains. Like. It's quite hard to explain, but you walk up and you see it, and you've heard about this and
heard about a train.
You've heard about a train. You know, people catch the train. You know, and you sort of stand there for a while, and
so there's no public transport.
There's a version of public transport. There's sort of public-ish buses, but
you would have never needed it.
Never, and we never would catch it or do anything. It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
And it's very poor. So yeah, and obviously going into a grocery store when I left Zim at the time, there was very little there was no variety of stuff. There was cereal. There was one cereal or two cereals or something like that. And yeah, walking like down the cereal aisle and being like, there's like 1,000 different things to choose from. You know, like I was just blown away. Whereas before that, I'd been hoping there's going to be cereal. You know, that sort of thing.
Cost of that cereal.
Oh, well, that was the other thing. Then there was the cost. But I mean, more it was just, was it going to be there? You know, a lot of, at that stage, what there was what there was, you know. There wasn't milk. There was like powdered milk or something like that, you know, whereas, yeah, I know there's probably a lot more variety now than there was 20 years ago, but...
Derek, you wouldn't have survived back then.
No.
Derek milks his own almonds, yeah. If that makes sense. Is that right, Derek?
Well,
you probably would have survived then.
I do that for my wife. Milk.
Well, if he had an almond tree. But,
so, I do that for my wife.
And how long, just talk us through, little sideline here, the almond milking process, how do you do it?
So you soak the almonds overnight.
Yeah.
Basically.
In
water.
Yep.
You drain them next day, put them in a Thermomix with 740 mils of water.
And for those who don't have a Thermomix, it's a...
a machine.
A very expensive...
It's a blender.
Right. Okay. I know what it is. I'm trying to help our
Who doesn't know what a Thermomix is, mate?
Derek.
Come on. Are you joking?
What's the email address?
It's themenwithissues@gmail.com.
Is that an email address?
It's an email address.
Okay. And anyway,
getting back to my milking.
No, yes, sorry. I was going to say, get back to the milking.
So I put it on the Thermomix. We blend it for a minute and a half. And then we've got a nut milk bag, which we pour it in. And squeeze.
What's that bag made of? Is it like a calico bag?
Do you call it Haitian, or is that a population
that's
of people?
That's a country. Yeah, if you're from Haiti, you would be Haitian.
So what's the bag called then?
Well, you're probably thinking of Hessian.
Hessian, yeah, that's right. It. Yeah, but yeah, yeah.
I think it might actually be calico.
Oh, it could be.
We can Google that later.
I don't know what calico is.
We can look that up on the Google.
And then after that, it's ready to roll, basically.
And so all of that effort, how many mils do you
get? A litre.
A litre out of how many?
Cup size almonds.
Okay.
But yeah, my wife goes a step further.
Oh, what does she do then?
So we soak the nuts overnight, and then next morning she's peeling them, and then she puts them in the blender.
Why? So it's less bitter?
I say the same thing.
Does it matter? Is there a taste?
But she points out,
roughage.
Do I drink it? No, I don't.
But how long does it take you to peel?
Oh,
100 and 200. How many nuts are they?
Long enough to get my breakfast ready. That's how long it takes her to do it.
Probably days.
What, and you couldn't just go out and buy your own milk for that price?
Yeah.
Well, you go and buy the milk, and it's got a very low percentage of almonds in the milk, plus some other stuff, you know, sugar, some gum stuff. Numbers, stuff that we don't want to consume, mate.
Why not?
Well, we're just, you know, we're purists.
Your wife's a peelist.
Anyway, she loves the milk.
Well, I was told
she's happy
by a doctor recently.
Yeah,
because I'd started drinking one of those 20 milk options there now are on the shelf, and I had started drinking the heart milk. That lowers your cholesterol by 10%. I don't know if you've seen it. You probably don't need to see it, James.
Derek, would they have had that in Zimbabwe, mate?
Derek's too busy soaking his nuts. And he said, don't drink that milk, just drink oat milk. Uh-huh. Because oat milk is good for lowering cholesterol in any event, like porridges or oatmeal. So maybe you should be soaking oats and milking
peeling
oats.
Those. Yeah. Oh. Peel, but peeling that's oats. My milk of choice.
Well, what we don't know?
Oat milk. Yeah, I like my oat milk.
I've never really tried it with a coffee or cereal. I can drink it.
Have you had an almond milk coffee?
Yes.
So the oat milk is a lot more creamy.
Okay.
So it's closer replacement to actual milk.
Well, I might have to give it a go then. Because almond milk can be hit and miss, I think. Any milk other than milk in a coffee can be hit and miss.
Now, are they juices or milks? Is it almond juice?
Yeah, see,
juice?
I think milk, it's a bit like champagne. You know, you can't create a sparkling white wine in Australia or anywhere else and call it champagne. And not that there is a milk region of the world, but I don't know how can they call it milk when it's juice, if it was almond juice, I don't think as many people would be buying it, would they? It doesn't sound as...
No. Well, it doesn't sound like a replacement.
It doesn't sound like a replacement.
Yeah.
So how can they get away with that?
Well, I suppose it goes back to how do you... I mean, if you're going to... The argument about champagne is they're defending a region, that it comes from that region. Where's milk? What are the cows going to defend themselves?
I would think it's the dairy industry. Because how much have they... how much money have the dairy industry lost? Because you go into the supermarkets now, and there must be 30 different non
dairy
bovine, what are they called? Bovine, non-bovine milk options. Oat, soy, almond, rice. Macadamia, rice, coconut. Brazil. Even the coconuts, they're calling it's coconut milk.
But it's always been called coconut milk.
Fair enough. So they have maybe a grandfather clause. And no one's putting coconut milk in their coffee, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, actually, some people do have it. It's revolting.
Oh, my God.
Have you ever tried it?
Coconut milk?
Oh. Absolutely shocking.
In what, cereal?
No, in a latte.
Oh, I've heard that. That's
really?
Oh, it's terrible. Terrible.
Well,
I see people drinking it and I'm thinking, you're not enjoying that.
I like the taste of coconut milk.
You're pretending to enjoy that because there's nothing enjoyable about it.
No.
It's awful.
And the only soy milk that I liked in a coffee, are we allowed to use brand names?
I can do it.
As long as we're not, other than the...
I don't think we're big enough just yet to get
don't worry, mate. Get in trouble. Facebook will be coming after me next week.
Really?
No, Meta.
Meta, sorry. Yeah. Bon soy. Do you remember Bon Soy?
What do you remember it? It wasn't like it was like 50 years ago, mate. It's out now.
Well, it was out. It was out and I loved it. And then people started getting really sick from Bon Soy because it had too much iodine in it.
That's right.
And they had to take it off the market. And people were having kidney issues, like severe. So if you had 5 or 6 cups a day and you were on the Bon Soy, you're in trouble. We'll delete this if that's defamatory.
So, James, you mentioned earlier when you came to Australia, there wasn't many black people around. I actually found very similar thing, actually, when I came from England, how I was quite confronted by the fact that there was just Caucasians.
Mm.
For me, it actually felt a little bit unsettling because... Growing up in England, hearing about Australia, my assumption was I would see the integration of the Aboriginals with the, what would I call them,
Mark? Anglo-Saxons.
Anglo-Saxons.
Europeans.
But similar sort of interaction like we I grew up with in England. So I was quite surprised not to see that blend, you know, when I came to Perth.
Derek, do you mind backing up a little bit just for me? How old were you when you moved here?
21.
Okay.
And you came a couple of times and went back.
Yeah, I was a whinger.
So a bit like you, you didn't have boarding school to go back to. You just wanted to go back to...
Well, I just left because I was just... I couldn't handle it here. Just could not handle it. I came here and it just was a small town.
I had this discussion with someone the other day. People were calling Perth a country town. I think it was a country town when I first came here because I moved to Perth in 1976, I think, 77, from remote Western Australia. If Perth was a city in America, it'd be the fifth biggest city in America. And Sydney would be, I think, the second biggest city in America.
On what metric?
On population. So we're the same size as... Perth's the same size as Houston. And Melbourne is bigger than Chicago. America has... thousands of small towns and cities that are virtually next door to each other. But, you know, Sydney is one of the biggest Western cities in the world. It's bigger than just about every city other than New York and London and Tokyo, I would think, as far as like, it's not bigger than Mumbai or Mexico City, but it's a big city. Perth is almost 2.5 million people now. It's
But I think when people make the comment of it being a country town, it's not so much
more the
around.
Feeling,
and I think going back 20 years, it didn't have a lot going on.
It was quite confronting because it just felt like I was trapped. I had nowhere to go. you know, so far away from where I grew up, I just felt it was not the place for me. And I lasted 8 months, complained every single day. And as soon as I got on that plane, I was so happy.
Did you grow up in London?
Yeah, East London.
And was that?
A place called Essex.
Okay, and I'm not familiar. Was it, is how London is for me? Everybody lives on top of each other in tiny little boxes and...
Pretty much. Like? Semi-detached.
Rain's most of the year. It's cold. Yeah. It's grey.
Yeah,
it's cold.
The food wouldn't have been amazing back then.
No, well, fish and chips.
Yeah. What more do you want? Couldn't wait to get back there, could you?
What more do you want? Pie and mash.
Yeah.
What more do you want?
Pub on the corner.
Pub on the corner.
What was school like?
Well, I went to a comprehensive school, which is obviously mixed-sex school. And it was pretty rough.
Was it a government school?
Yeah, a government school.
Does everybody go to government schools here?
If you're not mega wealthy, yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's a sort of elitist private school operation.
It's very similar to the African and Australian system in that way, isn't it? Mm. You've got essentially free schooling, or you can spend as much money as you like. Yeah.
They called it public school in England.
Yeah, it's the opposite. Yeah, the public school is the school that you spend $50,000 a year at.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Even here, you know, the public in Perth, the PSA is the Public Schools Association.
Which doesn't make any sense.
Because it's based on that English system of public schools being the schools that you pay for, which is some weird, British thing.
But growing up in England, you know, most of my friends were, my two best friends, one of them was Pakistani and the other one was from India.
Right.
And because the neighborhood that I grew up in, which is called Forest Gate, you know, had lots of migrants there. So it was a place that was very mixed. And so, like I said, coming to Perth after being in that environment, it was quite confronting not seeing different cultures. It's great now. A lot's changed now. But at first, it was very, very difficult.
But Derek, we had... You know, when you get here, we had different cultures. We had people from north of the river and people from south of the river.
He did. But one of the things that I actually want to chat with you about, James, is whilst I was growing up, you know, we discussed earlier about how I did my ancestry DNA and it's come back a mixture of Irish, African, bit of Scottish, bit of English. And I'm actually adopted. So my biological father was from Jamaica and my biological mother was from Ireland. The family that adopted me were a fantastic family and they were from a place called Guyana in South America. And so they came to London in the 60s and around that time is where they adopted me. Whilst I was at school, obviously, you know, trying to fit in. And so I felt like I belonged more with the black kids at school. But if, say, for instance, when you're with kids and that and you're hanging out and someone's upset one way or the other about something, I remember these kids saying to me, "You think you're black, don't you? But you're not black." And that actually quite hurt me because I felt that, well, what am I? And then say I'd hang out with the white kids and a similar sort of thing would happen. You know, you think you're white, don't you? But you're not white. And it was very, very sort of confusing. And one of the most hurtful things, actually, that I found that the black kids would say more so is that you're a half caste. Mm. And I absolutely hated that. I sort of gravitated more to the neutral kids, which were the Pakistani and Indian kids. And they didn't have an opinion about me whatsoever. Mm. Just like, you're Derek and that's it, right? But it was quite interesting to find, even now, the age I'm at now, I still think back at those times and I'm a bit sort of upset. Mm. I found that quite difficult. But like I said, I mean, you know, I've made some those two amazing friends, which I'm still friends with them today.
I wonder if it's different now there.
Is when I went back to England in 86, I remember I was at this restaurant with some friends and this black guy came up to me and said to me, out of nowhere, "Are you a half caste?" And it was like, I was in shock. You know, I couldn't believe how someone would come up to me and say that.
Was that acceptable then?
Well, no, because the friends I was with were quite appalled. I mean, it's just certainly not acceptable now, but even saying mixed race is not acceptable now either. People assuming that there's a superior race if you're a mixed race. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So, but how did you find any of that in Zimbabwe? That sort of
the interesting thing I think of that is that you often talk about the experience of white people. This is going to be very general.
Yeah.
Of white people, and then often of black people.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting case because of the fact that obviously you're sort of in that middle ground and in a minority to a point where you're probably almost on your own to some degree. Do you know what I mean? So there can be a degree of white people like this or black people like that, but at least there's that degree of grouping, I suppose, where you find your people. And even if people are treated badly as such, they've got an identity and it's who they are. You know, they might be treated badly, but that's who they are. Whereas to say, oh, you don't fit with us. You know, this is us. We're proud of who we are, even though we might be lesser in people's eyes. Yeah. You're not one of us.
Yeah.
You know, that's quite interesting.
That's exactly how it felt. When I was about 16, I was going out with this girl and she was Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I went out with her for about maybe 6 months or so. And I said to her, so when am I going to meet your family? Right. And she goes, yeah, well, you'll meet my family. Oh, okay, then, cool. So anyway, so finally I get to go around to her home. I knocks on the door and her mum answered the door. And I said, oh, hi, I'm Derek. And she goes, yeah, come in. So I go in. She was lovely, offered me a cup of tea, cake, we're chatting away, you know. I'm like, you know, ruling the afternoon, you know. I thought, yeah, she loves me, this woman. Anyway, next day I see my girlfriend and I say to her, so what did your mum think? And she goes, my mum said you was as black as the ace of spades. And I thought, fantastic.
Wow. Yeah, well, everyone's got their 50 shades of grey.
Yeah. Well, we better wrap things up now.
Yes.
So, James, thank you very much for coming on the Men With Issues and chatting about your life in Zimbabwe and life in Australia.
Thanks. As I said, I really appreciate you bringing me on, and it's been really interesting to hear a bit about both of your backgrounds because I didn't, and I'm not sure if anyone else had heard about
it. We like to keep a bit of mystery, don't we?
Yeah, we do. You leave today with a Men With Issues podcast mug. For being a so guest. Chuffed.
Limited edition.
And it's numbered.
What is the number on this one, James? Just so
I've got 8164.
8164.
Which then leads me to question. I thought there were only five of these made.